Today, we are very honored and privileged to have with us Dr. Mark Humayun, one of the leading experts in vitreoretinal surgery, bioengineering, and innovation. Dr. Humayun, you've been central to so many of the discoveries that have driven the field forward in so many different ways. So it's just such a great delight to speak with you today.
Well, thank you, Dr. Singh, and Mandeep, thank you for taking the time and allowing me to discuss this new area of research that we're very excited about.
So, Mark, going through your extensive list of publications and contributions, all the stuff you've done, it strikes me a little bit that you're a little bit of a tinkerer in addition to being a thinker. I mean, you like to invent things. Can you tell me a little bit about where this came from in your childhood or early education?
Well, yes, that's the exciting part of it, is always to try to innovate. And, as a child, I was very curious. I loved to, investigate things, started with astronomy and then various gadgets, electronic gadgets. So I always enjoyed trying to figure out, how something works. And then when we got into medicine, the thing that really got me interested in, and in particular in ophthalmology, is what the unmet need was. And in this particular case, we as retina specialists have been struggling with macular degeneration, in particular dry macular degeneration, especially as it gets advanced. There are other conditions like glaucoma, of course, severe diabetic retinopathy, inherited retinal degeneration. So, my mind immediately tries to go to solve those difficult and chronic problems in the eye.
One of your pieces of work, perhaps among the very most impactful, is something that's very close to my heart. It pertains to stem cell therapy, which is something that I work on in my lab. Can you tell us a little bit about where and how the initial idea came from? What was the spark behind the idea to create a stem cell patch to treat advanced dry age-related macular degeneration?
This project of using, a stem cell patch to treat advanced geographic atrophy is something that came about from a number of different ways. Number one, I think we have this enormous opportunity to try to restore back photoreceptors through by putting a RPE, retinal pigment epithelial patch, so without the need of creating a synapse. As you know from all your work, and as we know from the field, once you have to create a neuronal synapse, that challenge is significantly higher. So, when we looked at this, we thought there's a real opportunity without having to create new synapses or synaptogenesis, and having our new RPE layer there could rejuvenate and bring back the photoreceptor. So that was sort of the first thought. And then, there was work, as from autologous RPE from the same eye, when we would take the RPE from the periphery and move it to the center, and it ended up restoring, dramatic, three, four lines of vision. So that was the proof of principle, so to speak. But of course, the harvest site where we took the RPE led to a PVR, retinal detachment. So that wasn't a good place to harvest RPE. So the idea of being able to restore sight, but without creating synapses, the idea that RPE layer, once we can put it in that area of atrophy, will restore sight, led us to now, us and others, to think about, well, where else can you get the RPE cell to put it there, and how can we get it there? So it was those sorts of dots that allowed me to piece it together. And I think the interest I had in this area was that I saw that suspensions alone, RPE cell injections alone, may not be able to do provide the maximum level of treatment effect. So that led us to develop this biological scaffold. And so we can now put the RPE cells in a single layer, polarized as a monolayer, and therefore get the maximum effect out of them.
For me, an intriguing part of your construct is actually the scaffold that supports the RPE monolayer. And you have parts of that scaffold that are submicron thickness, and that allows for diffusion of materials to and from the cells. How did you go about designing that scaffold? And what's your thinking about whether this will be a really critical component going forward of retinal stem cell therapy in general?
I think the question about the scaffold is something that's still open and still debated. You know, some people think you don't need a scaffold and you can just put a suspension of embryonic stem cell derived or IPS derived RPE. Others believe that you do need a scaffold or a membrane to carry these cells in and orient them. You know, we are sort of in the latter group. And so we looked at different types of scaffolds. Of course, wouldn't it be nice for the scaffold to be there and then erode away, and so you're just left with the cells? We started with erodible scaffolds, but we quickly found out that, you know, we didn't know when the scaffold should erode. In some conditions, it needed to be around longer and some shorter. Also, these scaffolds, for example, if they're made out of PLGA, when they break down, they release, you know, acidic type of subcomponents, which can lead to inflammation and macrophages, which is not good for a new graft of cells and can lead to rejection and damage to those cells. So long story short, after many, many years, we ended up in picking a scaffold that's non-erodible, and it's made out of the most biocompatible material. So it's a USP class 6 material called perylene. Chemical name is paraparaxylene. It's been used for decades for coating wires for implantable devices such as cardiac pacemakers, et cetera. And so we used that material. But the key was, just as you pointed out, we needed to create these thin and thick sections. We couldn't make the whole membrane 0.4 microns to allow the diffusion back and forth between the choroid and the retinal pigment epithelium, because then the scaffold would be too thin to surgically implant. So we literally had to make these thick and thin sections. We did a lot of diffusion calculations so we can actually roll it up, put it in, so it surgically will be tolerated and withstand the surgical procedure and yet have the diffusion characteristics similar to the Brooks membrane. So I think this was took a lot of development. Now, you know, one quick fact is one would think, well, why didn't you just make this scaffold like a Swiss cheese, made holes out of it? Wouldn't that be a lot easier than making thin and thick and thin sections? And the reason that doesn't work, we found out, is that the cells will then grow through the holes, no matter how small they are, to the other side, and then cover the membrane from both sides and lead to sort of creating a cocoon around the membrane. So they don't work. So in order to get them to be on the one side, in order for them to be polarized, in order for that diffusion to occur across the membrane, we had to use what's called photolithography, which is ways computer chips are made. So where you can etch out and make thin and thick sections.
That fascinating piece surely required the input of a whole team with diverse backgrounds and professional expertise, you know, bioengineers, physicists, material scientists. Was this your particular bioengineering background, Mark? You come from a dual background in medicine as well as bioengineering.
Yes, this kind of a scaffold does require obviously an understanding of Brooks membrane, the biology of the retina, the understanding of retinal pigment epithelium, but also a significant understanding of engineering, especially micro fabrication in this case. And so I do have a background, as you point out, in biomedical engineering, and obviously, you know, well versed in retina. So I was able to think through that with a team of people, as you mentioned, researchers that I work at Caltech here in California, as well as biologists at USC and UC Santa Barbara. Really, it was a consortium, a group effort to develop this membrane so it is biocompatible and such that it can be placed, you know, underneath the retina and without damaging the retina and without the host environment damaging these cells.
Most encouragingly, beyond the extensive preclinical testing, this patch has now been placed in human research participants. And so could you take us through the most important highlights of the clinical findings regarding safety and efficacy?
So this product, which we call the CPCB patch one, actually went through rigorous preclinical studies over many, many years, and we were able to obtain an IND from the FDA to do a phase 1/2a study, which was, so to date, we have implanted 15 of these subjects with end-stage geographic atrophy. So, you know, pretty big areas of geographic atrophy, vision of 20/200 best corrected or worse. And so we implanted these patches into these subjects. And what we learned is something very, very interesting. First is that, about 27% of the subjects had improvement in vision. By that, I mean, you know, more than one line improvement of vision. Some had two and some had three lines of improvement in vision, which, as you know, in geographic atrophy is really very, very difficult to obtain, because once the area is atrophic and damaged, that's a very difficult thing to actually get improvement in vision in that area. I think the second thing that we learned from these studies, which was very interesting, which is that these cells were highly mismatched relative to the host. In fact, you know, about 50% was the most match on HLA antigens 1 and 2 between the donor and the host. And so, we only applied a very short course of immunosuppression for 60 days with tacrolimus and a very light dose of that. And thereafter, we didn't. And what we learned is that these cells survive, even though they're highly mismatched. Once you get them there in a monolayer oriented properly, they don't require chronic immunosuppression, in spite of the fact that they're highly mismatched. And that data came from not only being able to look through at OCT at the membrane, and you can see the cells on top of them, but more importantly, one of the subjects passed away from unrelated causes, and we were able to get her eyes and look at it, obviously histologically, which showed that these cells were still there, they were oriented properly, and they were actually having phagocytic activity where they were taking rod outer segments in those RPE cells. So I think, you know, that was something that we didn't know how it was going to turn out, but it's so exciting to see that. And the third bit of data, which just got published in Ophthalmology this month, is that the 27% who gained vision maintained their vision 3 years or longer. So people always ask, well, how long will this patch last? You put it into a very hostile environment. After all, the host RPE died in that environment, so to speak. So how long will these cells live? And so far, they've lived to 3+ years, and they continue to do well. We had a good idea and a good feeling that they would last, because when we compared it to older cells of RPE, and when we stressed them with, for example, hydrogen peroxide or some other type of noxious environments, the cells that were embryonic stem cell derived cells were much more robust, tolerated those insults and those tough environments much, much better than the older cells. So those were the three learnings: the improvement in vision, the fact that these cells survived in spite of being highly mismatched without immunosuppression, and that the increase in vision actually has lasted to 3+ years.
Mark, I'm sure you, like many of us, appreciate that patients with severe geographic atrophy are really at the older end of the AMD spectrum. And we're talking people in their 70s, 80s, and older than that. Do you see a future where the perioperative immune suppression can be minimized even further? Because we worry about side effects in this age group.
Immunosuppression is something that we are very concerned about in this elderly population. So, we wanted to not even use it at all, but the FDA said, you're not going to put a patient through a subject through surgery and all of this, and then have the graft be rejected. So in this first study, We had to use a short course. In some of the preclinical studies, you know, they're it's a human cell to, you know, an animal, and in that case, the xenograft, so to speak, survived even though we didn't use systemic immunosuppression. We just used local immunosuppression, and as you know, we have great ways to deliver that through the various steroid implants like Ozurdex, etc. So I believe that, you know, not for this next trial. So we're doing a phase 2B study now starting in the fall, which we'll try to see how we can, you know, build on the phase 1-2A results. In this study, we're going to have to stick to the protocol that I just described with the immunosuppression. But I think that, you know, going forward, you could either not need it or use local immunosuppression to help out. And that's going to be a big game changer, as you said, especially in these elderly patients.
So let's talk a little bit about adverse events. Do you think that, you know, in this kind of surgery, are they mostly coming from the biologic piece or the delivery procedure, which is fairly a complicated surgery for the retina?
The adverse events that we showed came mostly from the surgical procedure, but they were fairly minor. Let me go over them with you. So 5 out of the 6 steps we do all the time in vitreoretinal surgery, as you know, we do vitrectomy, we remove the hyaloid, we put subretinal fluid underneath the retina, you know, we do air fluid tamponades, we put perfluorocarbon. I mean, these steps are all things we do, but the step that we don't do is really put the patch underneath the retina, so to fold it and unfold it. And so that does require a little bit of learning, so to speak. And so, we, you know, now we've had, you know, 5 surgeons trained on this, and it takes 1 or 2 sort of days in a, you know, in a cadaver type of an eye setting to get comfortable with the injector tool and the scaffold loading and unloading. But the adverse events we did see were related to the retinotomy. We made the retinotomy small because we can. It was about 1 millimeter or so to get the scaffold through. We didn't want to make large retinotomies because those can obviously, you know, 3-4 millimeter retinotomies can end up getting scarring and PVR and retinal detachment. So we really wanted to limit that retinotomy. And what happens is if you don't cauterize and treat that retinotomy, you know, well, that retinotomy while you're putting the device in or thereafter can ooze a little bit. And so you get some subretinal hemorrhage. It's not huge, but it's just enough where we obviously we don't want that because that can bring in inflammatory cells and create a different type of reaction. So, but in the second cohort of subjects, as we reported, once we applied the diathermy, we did not get the subretinal hemorrhage. So, you know, these are learnings. I mean, how much do you put in, how much you don't? But now we know that at the retinotomy, you have to be a bit more judicious and apply the diathermy or, you know, better around that so it doesn't even leak or ooze either intraoperatively or postoperatively. So in some, you know, most of the steps of the procedure we're very, very used to. Just you have to spend some time dissecting the retina over the area of atrophy. Can't be too fast with that. Can't be too aggressive with that. And then, you know, deploying, loading and unloading the patch underneath the retina.
Tell us a little bit about your insights about mechanism, Mark. Mechanism of vision improvement. You know, the canonical thinking is that in the very center of a geographic atrophy lesion, you've got such extensive loss of photoreceptors that you need to repopulate those neurons. But maybe at the edges of the GA lesion, there's other cells that are not so completely degenerated. So which loci do you think these improvements are coming from? What's the mechanism of people actually gaining lines of vision?
Yeah, the mechanism of vision gain is indeed something that's very interesting and something that is, I think, still open for debate. But you know, the idea that these photoreceptors are all gone and then, you know, they're all or nothing is really a very simplistic idea. You know, there's a continuum. There's some areas like you said, they are gone. And other areas, you know, they're there, but they're affected by the disease. And then in further out areas, you know, they're less affected or perhaps even relatively normal. So the idea is that the RPE will bring back the outer segments of these photoreceptors and, you know, make them function better. Those that are moderately diseased to severely diseased, but are yet not absent. So I think that's the exciting part. You know, we do see, expect to see improvements in the area of the GA and the area of the peri-GA and right around the GA, geographic atrophy. We published a paper on Science Translational Medicine, which made the cover, in which we showed that the fixation actually returned over the center of the perylene of the patch. So, you know, those cells definitely, it's not eccentric fixation. Those subjects are not getting better at using their eccentric vision to be able to get these gains. It's actually the vision does return to the center over the patch that leads to the improvement of vision.
I really enjoyed reading your paper, Mark. That was something that early on in my career was just amazing to see. It was encouraging to all of us researchers working in this field. So, you know, thanks for putting that out. There's still some ways to go before this patch hits the clinic and we can all use it in the OR. What are the next steps between now and getting it into the patients?
The next steps, which we're addressing in phase 2B, is that we now have a cryopreserved version of it. So it can be shipped anywhere in the country and frankly around the world. Before that, in phase 1-2A, we had to use fresh product. But now we have a cryopreserved product that's thawed in the operating room before you put it in. And so we had to get FDA approval and go through all the testing for that. So that's one thing. And that the second thing is that in the 2B trial, we're allowed to enroll subjects with slightly better vision. So we're not at the severe end stage to see if, as we know, you know, healthier retinas we're just talking about could end up getting us a more percentage of patients who improve in vision. So I think we look forward to those. And of course, now it's going to be a multi-site study. So we're aiming to at least get 5 sites to enroll with different surgeons. And so, you know, those are the immediate criteria to sort of build it out towards, phase 3 study. And if our results continue to look so good, and as they have in 1-2A in the 2B trial, you know, then it would be time to do a larger phase 3. But those are the 3 things we're doing, you know, testing the cryopreserved product, implanting it in subjects with better vision, and, you know, doing this surgery in multiple sites, up to 5 sites.
And so this is the final question. It's a forward-looking query. Where do you think this patch will fit into the treatments that 10 years down the road we will have for dry macular degeneration and geographic atrophy?
Well, if we were to look at the crystal ball, that's a tough question as to how this would fit into the treatment of geographic atrophy. You know, I think the current complement factors we have, and we have 2 of them that are FDA approved, they slow down the progression of geographic atrophy. And so, you know, I think that, you know, that they would probably be used to slow down the disease to some extent. But, you know, once the disease starts to really encroach or get close to the fovea or certainly be subfoveal, I think at that point, we know that these complement factors are not going to improve your vision. At that point, you would need something like this patch, which can be implanted and restore sight. So I think that's the continuum. Injections are easier, obviously, both on the patient and safer for the patient, and also something we're very used to doing. And so we would start with those in these conditions of early geographic atrophy. But I think if it was me, and, you know, we showed that this patch worked and, you know, the geographic atrophy had walked into the fovea, I would certainly opt for this, something like this.
Well, Mark, it remains for me to congratulate you and your team on this groundbreaking development and all the new knowledge that you've propelled into our field. So thank you very much. It's been so fun speaking with you. Hope to see you soon.
Thank you for having me, Mandeep.